This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Sister Helen Prejean is known for her book, Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty in the U.S. This was made into a major motion picture with Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. Prejean returned to Charlottesville recently for a talk sponsored by the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice.
Sister Helen Prejean. She probably doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'll give you one anyway. Sister Helen is a native of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She's a sister of St. Joseph of Medai. She received her undergraduate degree from St. Mary's Dominican College, New Orleans, in 1962. And she did her graduate studies at St. Paul's University in Ottawa, Canada. Okay, Canadians in the house? Okay, there we go. Sister Helen began her prison ministry in 1981 when she dedicated her life to ministering to the poor of New Orleans. While living in the St. Thomas Housing Project, she became pen pals with Patrick Saunier, the convicted killer of two teenagers sentenced to die in the electric chair of Louisiana's Angola State Prison. Upon Saunier's request, Sister Helen repeatedly visited him as his spiritual advisor. In doing so, her eyes were opened to the Louisiana execution process. Sister Helen turned her experiences into a book that put the country and the world on notice, Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty in the United States. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 31 weeks. It has been translated into at least 10 different languages. Sister Helen continues to work and travel extensively to educate the public about the death penalty by lecturing, organizing, and writing. As the founder of Survive, which is a victims advocacy group in New Orleans, she continues to counsel not only inmates on death row, but the families of murder victims as well. Sister Helen has served on and led the board of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. She is also a member of Amnesty International and an honorary member of Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation. The recipient of honorary degrees and awards far too numerous to mention for her tireless advocacy for justice, Sister Helen published her second book, The Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, in December 2004. In it, she tells the story of two men whom she accompanied to their executions, both of whom, Sister Helen believes, were innocent of the crimes for which they were executed. Sister Helen examines in this book how flaws inextricably entwined in the death penalty system inevitably lead to innocent people being executed and render the system unworkable. Without any further ado, I give you Sister Helen Prejean.
Thank you. My own introduction of myself is just simply to say, with you, I am a Christian and on a journey, and I want to share some of the things I've learned along the way. Still unfurling, still learning, as we all are. And that's the beauty of the life in the Spirit, in which we keep learning and we share with each other, and that's the beauty of community. So thank you for coming tonight, and I'm glad to be here with you. Now I want to utilize every minute we have together, because it's precious to be able to share some of our deep inner life with each other. I know it's going to be kind of one-sided because I'm going to do most of the talking, but we are going to have some conversation together, and I hope that we get to hear from some of you as well. When I say a journey, I really do mean a journey, folks. And I got to tell you, I did not always understand about the connection between social justice and the gospel of Jesus. I mean, I grew up, I'm as Catholic as you get. I'm Catholic in my DNA molecules, Catholic mom and daddy, went to Catholic school. We had priest over at the house, you know, Eucharist, rosary, grew up on the rosary. I mean, when we had these family trips and we're traveling in a station wagon and the kids would get boisterous on the back seat, somebody would say, shut up, now we're going to have to do another rosary. But it was too late. And there was Mama, in the name of the Father and of the Son. And after you go through the joyful mysteries of the rosary and the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary and the glorious mysteries of the rosary, I mean, 150 Hail Marys, it's Catholic riddling is what it is. But also that you could be riotous and laughing 1 minute and the next minute you could be in prayer and learning to find the presence of God in all things. And that prayer isn't a question of what mood you're in, but it's learning to come into that place where God is present, where love is present, where freedom's present, where the center of our being is present. Still learning that, of course. I don't always do it. And my life gets hectic just like everybody else. But you learn a spiritual practice where you build in time so that we're coming out of our center. Or as Ignatius of Loyola, if I may mention a Jesuit in the presence of these good Dominicans, said that the heart of spirituality and being drawn by the Spirit, of following the Spirit, is to be in touch with our deepest desires. But see, we live in a consumerist society and we live out of imitative desire. Like, this is what you really want, this car. You ever been looking at car advertisements on TV? I mean, these cars are like God. They use divine language about what this car is going to do for you, what it's going to do for your marriage, what it's going to do for your children, what it's going to do for your future. I mean, getting the right car is like heaven on earth, according to them. And we get sucked into this. They looked at young girls' magazines. It's to be thin, it's to be beautiful. And imitative desires. We think we want things. But only when we are in that place of meditation and prayer do we know who we really are, what we really want. And that's always with community that we figure it out. Sitting here tonight with you to my left is Marie Deans. And Marie Deans was one of those women I met early on after I awakened to the death penalty, was one of the first people in this country to stand up for murder victims' families, not to call for execution when her mother-in-law Penny was killed. And she's someone, I refer to it as both arms of the cross, and we're going to be taking that journey tonight about what the call of Jesus really calls us to. Marie has accompanied over 30 people to execution, and she has fought for her clients to live. And yet she's also started with murder victims' families, far more than I've ever done. And she's been through the personal agony and sorrow of having someone she loved deeply murdered. She was one of the first to stand up and show the way to all of us. I'm one of the people that's continued on that path. And I'm going to ask Marie, when I'm there signing books tonight, if she would just come and be by me, because some of you may really want to talk to her. You want to talk to her, if you could just have even a few minutes. So the journey. We start out as children, we grow, we go to school. I became a nun. Our nuns were great teachers. I wanted to be a teacher. I'm still a teacher. You know, the classroom changed a little bit. And so I become a sister, and so I become a director of religious ed in the parish. And in the late 70s or so, it was really beginning to boil up in the community, all this about the poor and standing on the side of the poor and social justice. And I was doing retreats and at the community meetings. That's why you're always going to be humble with the people who know you best, because they remember these things I was saying when we were having these debates about, don't you think some of us ought to be directly involved with poor people? None of our sisters anymore are involved with poor people. We had sisters in Latin America who were beginning to come back and say, look, the place of the church is on the side of the people who have no voice, where nobody's standing up for them. That's where the gospel of Jesus ought to be, and I don't get it. I mean, I really don't get it. And so I'm getting up and saying, look, the poor, the poor, the poor. We keep talking about the poor. Who are the poor? The poor is anybody that doesn't have God. If the poor have God, they have everything. Now, of course, you know, I don't know any real poor people, you understand. And I lived out in the suburbs of New Orleans and had never once visited one of the public housing developments where over 50% of our people lived in poverty, African American people. And I came up from privilege. When we come up privileged, we don't even know we privileged. We like little goldfish swimming in a bowl. Everybody else is swimming in the same bowl. We don't even think about it. I went to Dominican College. I got a good education. I'm articulate. I know how to write. I can write a book. I don't even know what it means not to be educated. That whole part of New Orleans was sitting there, and I never had entered into it. And it had a lot to do with the way I understood about the gospel of Jesus. And that was like God's problem, the poor people of the world. You know, and please help the homeless tonight. Please help the poor. Now I was charitable and always been kind. Like, you know, in Thanksgiving time, you know, we get our canned foods and we give it to the poor. And that's good. We need charity. We can't make it without charity for one another. But justice, boy, and I was really getting upset of all these discussions on social justice. Then I heard we were going to go to this three-day meeting at Terre Haute, 3 days, and the nun that was going to come talk to us was one of those social justice nuns. 3 full days of more of this social justice stuff. So I thought, humbly, well, with God's grace, I can come through unscathed. We've had these discussions before. First day I did, she told us about the first world and then the developing countries and how many kids are going to bed hungry every night, people that are dying from malnutrition. But you know, I knew the statistics basically. I even knew that we were 6% of the world's population and we use up to 40% of the world's resources in America. I went, I know we should do better and maybe we need to get rid of some of these SUVs. But I mean, really now, isn't that the way the world's always been? Isn't that even what Ecclesiastes says? There's nothing new under the sun. You got rich, you got poor. Hadn't Jesus even said, the poor you'll always have with you? So, hey, first day, I did come through unscathed. None of the statistics touched me. I basically knew them. And I'm thinking I'm one little person on this whole big planet. What is one little person going to do? That's God's problem. That's too big for us. And then she announced that the next day she was going to talk about Jesus. And truthfully, I thought I was home free because, well, like, excuse me, but I had meditated on Jesus quite a bit myself. I even did the 30-day spiritual exercise where you got to be quiet for 30 days and just talk to God. I mean, probably God was counting the last days, 28, 29. She's going to talk to us about Jesus. I mean, I'd gone to study scripture. I mean, I taught it in the parish. What am I going to know about Jesus? I didn't expect any surprises. And boy, that's when you got to watch out. That's when God sneaks up on you. Because there she is the next day. Here I am, notebook poised, Jesus. And I can tell you the line. Now, this is in Dead Man Walking. My spiritual journey is in Dead Man Walking. And I can tell it to you because it turned the spiritual trajectory of my whole life when she said this line, Jesus preached good news to the poor. So I'm going, yeah. I expected she was going to say, like, every hair of your head is numbered. God lets rain fall on the just and unjust. God is merciful and loving to all. And she said, integral to the good news that Jesus preached to the poor was that they would be poor no longer. I stayed seated just like you. Physically, I didn't move. But kaboom, that they would be poor no longer. I mean, and look, like, why was Jesus crucified? Why did they consider him a troublemaker? If he had been a dreamy spiritual preacher that just gathered people on hillsides, told them about the love of God, told them to reach out and pat their brother and sister to the, share their picnic baskets, whip out their guitars, everybody sing Love One Another right now, and everybody would have gone home. The Romans would never have crucified Jesus. Why was he a threat? Why was the religious hierarchy in the temple so angry at him that they would want to kill him? And it was not just what Jesus preached, it was the community he inaugurated. It was so threatening to everybody. the hierarchy in the temple saw all their holiness code, all their cleanliness, all their purification, clean and unclean people touching each other, healing people on the Sabbath where you're not supposed to do any work. They saw that happening. And the Romans, that the poor will be poor no longer means so that all these peasant farmers eking it out to try to make a living in Palestine where you could barely count on rainfall and miss, have two crops mess up, you're in debtor's prison. The most real parts of the Our Father that are probably the most literal are, give us this day our daily bread because people are starving to death and are dying from malnutrition, and forgive us our debts as we forgive those in debt to us. Because debt could kill you and two seasons of bad crops, and then you lose your land. And when you have landless peasants, then you have riots and upheaval in a country. Just look at Central America. Just look at what's happened. Look at Haiti. Look at Haiti and the social conditions of Haiti. Who took away all the wealth from Haiti? Why are there so many poor people in Haiti? So this community Jesus inaugurated was that this isn't God's will for you to be poor. This took us a long time to learn. In the modern church, missionaries for many years went to countries, announced to people about God's love, gave them the sacraments. But it's when liberation theology started coming in Latin America. What was it all about? To be on the side of the poor means we don't say it's God's will that these peasants are starving and their children are dying before they're 3 years old, and we do not join with them in their struggle for justice. And one of our sisters, Margie Navarra, who responded to the Pope's call for nuns to go into Latin America, and she was in Panama, and she was with her good friend, Hector Gallego, a newly ordained Panamanian priest. And so they were going into the jungles of Panama to get to very poor people. And they begin, then Hector is talking with the farmers, was talking with the people who were growing their crops. And they're saying, Father, one of our problems is that by the time we work and get all the crops, and then we give it over to the truckers who bring it to market, we get like 4 cents on every one of the, or just a few per, you know, bushel of grain, and we're losing it all, and there's nothing left for us and our kids. So they do a very natural thing. They say, well, look, let's become a cooperative, and then let's get a truck for all of us, and we'll bring our own crops to market, and we, the people, will be able to keep more of the money. Well, anybody that goes in business goes, well, of course. You join together, form a cooperative, and Hector's working with them on that. And then he begins to get threats against his life. It gets to be that anybody carrying a Bible is considered a revolutionary and is a threat to the government. And one night, Margie and Hector were supposed to go into the jungle the next day. Hector was in his little house, and Margie was in hers. And a truck, a National Guard truck, backs up to Hector's house. And they grab Hector and put him in the truck. And he's screaming and yelling and struggling. And then they hit him over the head with a gun. And he went silent. And he was never seen again. There were some rumors that he had been dropped over the ocean. There were some rumors he was in a mass grave with other people. What did Hector do? Hector connected the gospel of Jesus to the cry of the poor and began to work with them not to be poor any longer. And this can be traced to the Hebrew prophets. Jesus was seized by Isaiah, formed by Isaiah. So when he announced his mission, I've come to bring good news to the poor. And so justice and the poor began to be very connected. So it's bubbling up to us, and that's what's led to this meeting where I'm sitting here, where I've resisted it so hard. And I think I was resisting social justice so hard because I knew how to be a Christian, where you're charitable to people, you can pray for people, give God the big problems. Then you don't have to get involved in learning about public housing, learning about racism, learning about the death penalty, learning about criminal justice issues. It was easier. And I also really didn't have to use my mind that much, because when you pray, I wasn't doing social analysis because it was all up to God. Kaboom! We never know when we're going to be enlightened. And God's Spirit can hit us anywhere at any time. And it can be in a book. It can be listening to a talk. It could even be homilies given in this church. The Spirit of God moves in us, and we move when we're ready. Now, one sign that Ignatius of Loyola gives in the spiritual exercises is that when God's moving in our life, when we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, then we experience a peacefulness. Yep, we may get tired as all get out, but there's a satisfaction. There's a, yep, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I know this is right for me. When God's trying to move us out of that little groove, you know, we kind of have this feeling of anxiousness or restlessness, kind of like balloons hitting a ceiling. This is not Ignatius's image. This is mine, because I don't think he had balloons. But I know there's more, but I don't know what. So it's a time of confusion and anxiety for us, because we know we're being called. So it's a time of special discernment. I heard those words. Jesus preached good news to the poor, that they would be poor no longer. And of course, the heart of it all is the spiritual. The heart of it all is what we talked about earlier, of knowing our center, knowing we're grounded in God, knowing that we're grounded in community where two or three are gathered together, because that is always what it means to be a community that tries to follow the way of Jesus, because we can't do it by ourselves. It's just too big. And the powers arrayed against us are too big when we begin to work for justice. And then I realized I don't even know any really poor people. I'd been living out in the suburbs and I'd never gone. And so I did a simple thing. And that's all we're called to do. It doesn't matter how old we are when we wake up. It's that we begin to act out of what we know. And I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Development with African American people. And guess what I discovered? There were already people ahead of me who had wakened up to justice long before me. And so I'm with Sister Laurie Schaff, who founded Hope House in 1969. You know when I woke up? 1980. And then there I am with the other sisters, and there we are in the community. And she said, look, Helen, you don't have to have a blueprint in your back pocket of how you're going to abolish poverty. Just be neighbor to people and learn from them. And then your heart tells you what to do, because the issues of justice get to be so obvious. And so there I am with Earlene Johnson, and there she is telling me about her son and what had happened with him when the police picked him up when he was running on his way to his little job, taking him under the bridge and putting a gun to his head saying, kids, you better confess that you stole those things in the warehouse. And he was so upset when he got home, when they brought him home, because he thought sure he was going to be dead. And he said, look, my mama's name is Earlene Johnson. This is where she lives. You got to tell her what happened to me, because she's not going to know what happened to me. And that kid could never, never, whenever he saw a policeman coming down the street. That had never happened to me. I didn't know about racism in police forces. I didn't know how things worked. And kids coming into the adult learning center, and they're in the public schools in New Orleans. Okay, well, look, let's see how you are. And let's see how your reading is. How far did you get in school? 11th grade. Oh, look, you only got a little bit to go to get your GED. Yeah, it's not going to take much. Let's see your reading first. And they couldn't read a third grade reader. And then the 11th grade in a public school. And the next year, they're going to graduate and they can't read. All the public schools of New Orleans, when Katrina happened and all of our people were thrown into exile, they did a study in the Texas schools of all the Louisiana kids from public schools, and they all tested inferior to the kids in Texas, because our public schools have been going down the toilet for years. But the leaders of the city just sent their kids to private schools. I didn't know. I really didn't know. I knew public schools were not doing too well, but kids don't know how to read. And the people I was with in St. Thomas, who were my neighbors now and who were teaching me, these are the people who were left behind in the Superdome. How do you have a major disaster that happens in a city and you know it's coming, and your evacuation plan does not include over 100,000 people who didn't have cars. They didn't have cars. They had to rely on the buses. How does it happen? They were left to drown. The stories that were coming out. I remember this one girl said, we were looking at our TV. I said, y'all, this thing is big. Even if we got to rent a car, we got to get out of this town. And she said, well, you could look out the door and you saw all the people had cars. They're putting their stuff in and they're going to Atlanta. Are they going to Jackson, Mississippi? Are they going to Houston? I said, y'all, we got to get out of this. Let's rent a car. Let's go somewhere. And they're going, where are we going to go? We don't have money for a motel when we get there. You can't just rent a car and go along the road and run out of gas. And she said, we waited for them to come get us. And she said, you ever been hungry? Because we were there for 2 days and 3 nights. And all the water and all the food ran out. And she said, when you're really hungry, I would bend over. Like from the way she would just bend over. And just be like that so your stomach wouldn't hurt so bad. She said, we were watching people floating and drowning in the water. And then when we got to the Superdome, they left us there. People were committing suicide, jumping off the tiers. There was a rape of this young girl in the bathroom. There was chaos in the Superdome. Old people dying in their wheelchairs. And I knew people who were in cars near the Superdome, and they said people would throw themselves over the hood of your car and bang on the windshield and say, help us, help us. We all watched this happen in America, a major city. Who was left? Poor, for the most part, African-American people and elderly people were left behind. Is it perhaps because we let them drown every day in our inner cities? Poverty kills you. It kills you. Gandhi used to say, poverty, more people die of poverty than die from bullets, than die from guns, even with the wars. Poverty kills you. It also kills your mind because the kids in the school come away thinking, I'm stupid, I can't learn. It dies because the living wage is so pitiful that work used to be the way out of poverty and people are working and they still in poverty and young kids aren't stupid. And when the mainstream economy and American dream isn't working for you, you look for alternatives, and everybody in the neighborhood knew that the alternatives were drugs. And so we were seeing it all around us. So there was violence all around us. There was blood on the sidewalk one morning when we were walking to Mass. Somebody had been shot and killed that night. Then I began to notice something in the papers, in the Times-Picayune. That when Kenny Singleton, who was one of the first people, one of many, to whose wake and funeral we went, his sisters there were living with the people, his death was barely recorded in the newspaper at all. But every single time other citizens were killed, and they happened always to be white, their picture was in the paper and that they had been killed. Now, 20 years later, working with the death penalty, I know a lot about race and criminal justice. I really know that it's when white people are killed that that's the first determining factor to decide if you go for the death penalty or not. 8 out of every 10 people sitting on death row and 8 out of every 10 people have been executed is because they kill white people. It's not saying white people ought to be killed. Nobody ought to be killed. But doesn't that tell us something? That if you're a person of color and you're killed, it's not even a blip on the radar screen in the DA's office? That if the status of the victim is not, or someone who's regarded highly, there's no outrage felt over a death where people don't respect the person who's been killed. They found a policeman's notebook in New Orleans, gone to the scene of a crime, just another N-O-N, nigger on nigger. Two niggers killing each other. That's in the city of New Orleans. Is Virginia any different? And how does race play out here? And whose life is worthy and whose life isn't? And do we even know? Because I live so separated. And when I woke up I'm going to tell you, I felt so grateful that at last I woke up because it didn't come to me easily. I didn't get it right away. I resisted it. And I just, so now I'm in the Adult Learning Center. No big whoop. No white woman saving, coming down to save these poor black people who've been waiting for me all their life. Uh-uh. It was just justice. When I'd grown up as a young girl, my daddy was a lawyer. We had African-American servants in our family. The woman worked in the house and the man worked in the yard. And we knew them as Jesse and Mary. I don't think I ever even knew their last names. And we, Mom and Dad and all of us, always kind. But I never questioned segregation. I never questioned racism. So this is just justice. Here's the lawyer's daughter now being a servant for a change to the people in the African-American community and learning. Learning, always learning. There is no one on the face of this earth from whom we cannot learn. And when we arrive at a place where we say, gonna learn nothing from him, gonna learn nothing from her, and we start lumping people into categories, and then we really become myopic. And it's very hard for the grace of God to get moving in us. Because I lived in St. Thomas, there was a direct route to the death house. I didn't know that. I didn't know by living in St. Thomas and by working among people who were poor and struggling that soon I would learn the connection, hey, this is who's in the prison. Every family I knew in St. Thomas knew someone in prison. The way our family and our friends would talk about, hey, what college you going to? What college you going to? Everybody in St. Thomas talk about who's in what prison. And the young boys growing up, they had it in their eyes. You could see it in their eyes, or you could hear it in their conversation. I probably am going to spend some time in a joint. Probably. There's a lot of raid against them. And one day, coming out of that adult learning center, and it was very casual, I was coming out, a friend who had been in the prison coalition bumps into me, has a little clipboard, has a little project going on, and said, hey, Sister Helen, you want to be a pen pal, somebody on death row here in Louisiana? And it was 1982. I'd gone to St. Thomas in 81. And I said, sure, I could do that. I'm an English major. I can write some good letters. I never dreamed they were going to kill this guy, much less that I'd be with him as his spiritual advisor. But God's grace works in us. You know how the locks in ships work? You know, you want to get a ship, the water's here, and your boat's here, and you want to get down to here. Well, you don't just take your boat and leap into that lower level of water. You go in a lock, get to the next level, water comes up, go to the next level, water comes up. That's the way grace works. And so what happened to me is, hey, would you write, you want to be a pen pal, somebody on death row? Yeah, sure, I could do that. Wrote his name down for me, Patrick Saulnier. And I wrote the letter. The address impressed me. I never wrote a letter to somebody, your address is death row. I mean, it's got to be depressing to read your mail. I'm on death row. And I wrote the man. And you know what the problem was? He wrote back. And there was a relationship between this man on death row and me. And I don't know boo scat about the death penalty. I'm learning about all the social justice issues. But I wrote the man, and he wrote me back, and he wrote, and I wrote, and I'm telling him about Hope House, and he's telling me about life in a 6.5 by 8.5 foot cell where he's confined 23 hours, and how glad he is when the summer's over because it's so hot, and the mosquitoes can come in through the window, and sometimes he would take the sheet off the bunk and wet it in the lavatory and put it down on the cement floor, try to get a little coolness. And so it begins. He begins taking me into this weird, as I'm going to find out, very surreal world of state-sanctioned death, and I'm going to be with him. And I took it like the little ship with the water coming up. When the grace comes up under us, then we move. We have a maxim in our community, never leap ahead of grace. Boy, I used to be a big leaper. Sometimes I'd leap with grace, sometimes I'd leap without. But to move with grace, and we have all we need when I was moving with grace. So write the letter. Then he has no one to come visit him. He didn't even ask me to come. But now I'm meditating again on Matthew 25. How many retreats, how many classes in New Testament studies had I taken an exegesis of that passage with people? I was in prison and you came to me. I was hungry and you gave me to eat. And you know what I discovered about myself? Now maybe it applies to you. But we all are our own little spin doctors with these scriptures. Like, oh, I was in prison. Well, you know, you can be like psychologically in prison. Like if you shy, that's imprisonment. It didn't mean like prison. But see, I'm writing to a man and I realize he has no one to visit him. And I see the words and they go off like the 4th of July. And I wrote him a note. I'll come and visit you. And it all unfolded. It's like a rose. It's like petals. It's organic. It's no zapping and jerking. And suddenly I'm changed. We grow steadily. And so I grew with him teaching me. And I go visit him. And I take you through each of these experiences in Dead Man Walking. First time I saw his face, I was scared as all get out. I'd never been in a prison. The guards keep bringing me through these gates. Clang, clang, clang. There are no soft sounds in prison. No cushiony little even dentist music coming through a PA. It's all cement floors and metal and reverberating voices against the cement walls. And they lock me in a room, and we'll go get your man for you. And then I'm waiting for him, holding on to my cross, pacing back and forth, all these doubts. Anybody can write nice letters. I mean, he's been writing me nice letters, but I never visited with a murderer. I mean, I don't even know the crime yet. I know he did something. Are we going to be able to have like a normal conversation? And then the guards brought him in, and he was like locked in a booth across on this heavy mesh screen, and for the first time I looked up into his face, and I was shocked. I guess I thought, if you did murder, you look different, you know? Like your eyes are meaner or something. And he was smiling. I couldn't believe how human his face was. It looked like any of our faces here. And he said, "Sister, you came. A lot of people promise. They say they're going to come, and they never come. You drove all that way to see me. Think of the dignity that's in a human being with a visit, especially when you're on death row and you're treated like disposable human waste. You still have the words of the DA ringing in your ear. This is scum. This is vermin. Not fit to live among us. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, only death is fitting for this less than human being who did this terrible crime. And someone comes to visit you?" And the journey began then. And 2 hours flew. I didn't have to worry about what I was going to say. I was so glad to have a human presence. And after 20 years of this, of prison ministry, you know, one of the gifts of visiting in prison is you learn the essentials, that the best thing we ever give each other is our presence. Because there's no distractions. There's no, "Oh, let's go rent a video. Oh, let's go get a pizza." It's just the two of you there for 2 hours. And you talk and you pray. And instinctively at the end of that visit, I put my hand as close as I could on that screen so the tip of his fingertip could touch my hand. Because I could never touch him. The Gospels are filled with Jesus touching people. Even lepers touching people. You never touched. These supermax prisons, electronic doors, trays being pushed, never touched. You're dangerous. You're a security risk. You're not human like the rest of us. And he was my first encounter. I was driving home, and then I remembered he had said he had a brother who was serving a life sentence. And I realized I didn't even know the crime yet, but it was my first legal question about the whole system. How do you have a murder? One brother gets death, one brother gets life. And the Sonia case is more complicated than this, but later, as I began to learn about this, did you know if you have two co-defendants in a murder and there are no other witnesses, if one is willing to take the stand, point to the other one, under oath and say, yeah, he did it, they get a lesser sentence for doing that. And how do we know we're getting the truth? We never know if we get the truth because there was nobody else there. And so it began. I didn't go much into the legal then because I'm learning everything. And then, so I begin to visit Pat. So while I'm making the drive, I go visit the brother. And then a couple of months, I was over at the Prison Coalition office, and I didn't want to be naive. I know somebody's been murdered here, and I want to know. I'm going to let him, in his own time, when he trusts me enough, share with me the worst thing he ever did in his life. But it wasn't up to me to speed up that process and say, tell me what you did. But I didn't want to be naive. And I went in the Prison Coalition office, and I said, could I have some background on the Sonier case? They go, yeah, sure. And there they were, all in these manila, bland, legal-looking manila folders. And I opened the one on the top of the heap, and it changed everything because I'm looking into the faces of two beautiful teenage kids. David LeBlanc, 17 years old. Loretta Bork, 18 years old. And their pictures, the picture, the photo their parents sent in was them at the prom, their prom picture, where David's looking all handsome in his tux and Loretta in her evening dress. And then the terrible headline, teenagers found murdered. And now I know what Pat and his brother did. They kill two kids. And then I read the story of how on a November night, the kids had gone to a football game, a homecoming football game at Catholic High, in one of the little towns around Acadiana in Louisiana. And there was a local lover's lane near a sugarcane field, an abandoned place near the sugarcane field where kids would go. And the brothers were waiting in the field. They'd be rabbit hunting or doing whatever. 22 rifles. They'd always hunted their whole life. And the car would drive up. The brothers would approach the car. Five other teenage couples who had had this happen to them came forward when David and Loretta were killed. They had been scared before to come forward. No one was killed, but some of the girls were raped. And they approached the car and say, hey, did you know your kids, you're trespassing. We're the security guards. We work for the people that own us. You're on private land. You're trespassing. We're going to have to take you to the owners. Do your mom and dad know where you are tonight? The kids are scared. These guys have guns, flashlights. They're vulnerable. They're out there. And it would usually, what the other teenage kid said was that it went from, excuse me. Look, tell you what, we won't bring you to the owners if the girl, like, you know, has sex with us, which is rape. It's aggravated rape because they have guns. This night, as bad as that is, these kids are found lying face down near that sugarcane field, and they have both been shot in the back of the head. And now I know what they did. And I just want to speak here a little bit about who doesn't feel outrage when we hear about the death of innocent people. Like, these were two young kids. And I felt that. I still feel it. I felt it on every page of the book of Dead Man Walking that I wrote. That outrage over what they did and what the crime was. And then I bring you into the other outrage, which is what's happening. But the kids. And then immediately I think of their parents. It's every parent's worst nightmare. Your kids happy? David's mama had gotten him a new blue velour shirt. And he was standing over the kitchen sink, he and Loretta there in the kitchen, before they went to the football game. And he said, oh, mama, and he was rubbing his arm. Oh, mama, this is such a nice shirt. He said, it's going to keep me warm tonight. And Lloyd LeBlanc, his daddy, later said to me, yeah, but it couldn't keep him alive. And I think of the parents. And there was a nudge inside me. There was this, I ought to go to those parents. I ought to do something for the parents. But then I was scared, see, and I went, oh, no, they're not going to want to see me. I'm the spiritual advisor to the two people who killed their kids. It's going to get them upset. They're going to be angry. I'm not the bravest person in the world. I mean, I could picture the headline, nun shot on front porch of victims' families. I mean, I'm naturally cowardly. I mean, that's my, like, default mode. I've been talking to y'all about grace, but just me in my own default mode, I'm not a brave person. And I was just so unsure. I said, that could just get them more upset. Because what am I going to say? May I be of help to you? You're the spiritual advisor, the one who killed our kids. You're going to comfort the poor murderer. Our daughter didn't have a spiritual advisor when she's out there in that field. And we encapsulated this tension in the film, and it's also in the book, because it's real. And I stayed away. In my cowardice, I stayed away. I didn't write him a note. I didn't call him. I didn't do anything. And I met him at the worst possible time. It was a pardon board hearing, which is very public in Louisiana. And when you go in, you sign the book which side you're on. It's the closest we can come to like being in a Roman amphitheater. Are you on the side of the state that wants to kill? Thumbs down. Are you on the side of the defendant and you're going to ask for compassion? You want the person to live. And when I had a chance to dialogue with Pope John Paul, that's what I said. I said, you know, when you're there at the death penalty, when you're with someone who's being walked to their death, everything gets crystal clear about the gospel at that point. Because which side are you on? Are you for life or death? Are you for love or hate? Are you for vengeance, even though you legalize it? Or are you for compassion? That you can say, no, this is a human being too. And we're all worth more than the worst thing we ever do. It just cuts right down that fault line. And the cross of Jesus puts, it stretches us big time. And we live in a culture that says, choose sides. If you're going to be on the side of the one for the human rights of that person who did that, don't say you're for the victim's family. Well, boy, clearly I hadn't shown love to the victim's family. And I met them at this pardon board hearing. And it could not have been more polarized. And I met them. And they were furious. At first, the parents of the girl was just furious at me. To this day, they're furious at me. We've never been able to reconcile. I don't blame them. I put it right on me because I didn't reach out to them. And then they passed me by. We were right outside the door while they were voting inside the building. And then right behind them is the other family, the LeBlancs. Their son David was killed. And they're coming right up to me. If I could have escaped then, I would have run in too, but I was caught. It was a narrow space. And they walk right up to me. And Lloyd LeBlanc says, sister, this is my wife, Eula. It's our son, David, who was killed. And he just said to me, he looked in my eyes, he said, sister, all this time, you've been visiting with the two Saunier brothers, and you didn't want to come and see us. You can't believe the pressure on us about the death penalty. And I'm shocked that he said that. I didn't know victims' families were under any pressure about the death penalty. I thought all victims' families supported the death penalty. Because here's the state, here's the DA coming to them, some of them, and saying, this is how we're going to get justice for your dead child. This is how we're going to help you heal. Or the word closure began to appear when the death penalty appeared and we began to talk about victims' families. Before, it was a word that was only used in very select circles with psychologists. Suddenly, the word closure is in our vocabulary. And we're going to get you closure. Now, you have to wait 10, 15, maybe 20 years. But we can invite you in, and you're going to sit on the front row, and you're going to watch as you get your justice. And you owe it to your dead child. Because if you seek anything less than the ultimate penalty, it could look like you didn't love your child. And victims' families have had people say that to them. You're not for the death penalty. You lost your daughter. It's a shame you didn't love your daughter very much. Because people buy into this. It's part of the culture. It's part of the climate. This is what you do. And now this man is looking in my eyes and he's saying, sister, where have you been? And of course I had no excuse. I said, Mr. LeBlanc, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't think you'd want to see me. It was so lame. It was pitiful. He was the one full of grace. And he reached out to me. He said, "Sister, come see me. Come talk to me. Come find out what we go through." He said, "Look, I pray in this little chapel in St. Martin of Tours Church in St. Martinville, one of the oldest churches in Louisiana. And I keep vigil before the Blessed Sacrament. Come pray with me." And I absolutely knew I would. Here was an invitation of grace. He was being gracious. I had done it all wrong. And here was this father who had lost his only son reaching out to me. And so I went to pray with him in that little chapel. And so it was the first time in my life. This is long before I met Marie Deans, and I knew that there were other people who were victims, families, and who were standing up and saying, "Not in my name." Lloyd LeBlanc was my first teacher. And we begin the lesson together in prayer. And if you see the film of Dead Man Walking, it ends with the two of us kneeling in prayer together. That's the way that movie ends. Dead Man Walking is a huge spiritual journey on going on either arm of this cross, the suffering of the perpetrator and the perpetrator's family, and the other side, the victim's family. And we find ourselves stretching back and forth. What if somebody killed my child? If somebody killed my mother? And I'm going to learn almost all victims' families, the starting phase of it is that they want to take that person with their bare hands and they want to kill them. Almost everybody begins there. And kneeling alongside Lloyd LeBlanc, we said the rosary together. It was a Friday morning. It was the sorrowful mysteries. It was about the suffering of Jesus and his death and the suffering of his mother. And I prayed with this man. I realized he was praying for everybody. For David to be at peace with God. For Eula to be healed. He almost lost his wife. She almost had a mental breakdown with David's loss. They had to move his grave. He was in a family plot in another town. They had to move his body close to a graveyard so Eula can visit it every day. Which, how many years later? That happened in 77. She still does. I was at a Christmas meal with them last year. And we finished the meal. And Lloyd says, Vicky, that's his daughter, who has grandchildren for them, who helped bring Eula back to life. Says, "Vicky, you got the tree?" "Yeah, Daddy." "Batteries?" "Yeah, Daddy." "Okay, let's go." And we left. This is last year. We left the family table and went to the graveyard not far away at St. Elizabeth's, right nearby the house. And it was a little Christmas tree, and Vicky put it on David's grave and turned it on so the lights came on, and we all stood there and held hands. One father who had had a child killed said to me in his anger and in his pain, "Sister, they're on death row. We're on death row." Every night of my life when I put my head on the pillow, I'm on the think of my child and that I couldn't protect her. I'm her father and I couldn't protect her. Fathers are supposed to protect their children. And then with Lloyd, as I began to realize, he was the first one to teach me what forgiveness means. He said, "You know, people think it's weak. In our society, people say, 'You forgive, Lloyd. Didn't you love your son, man? That is weak.' Like it's okay, like you condone what they did to your boy." He said, "They automatically think forgiveness means you condone." And he said, "David was just 17. Every time he has a birthday, we lose him all over again. Condone. He'd be 21. He'd be 25. He'd be married by now. He'd be coming to the door with his kids around his knees, saying to Eula, 'Mama, you got something for us to eat,' like Vicky's kids. Condone," he said, "but here's how I see it. He's Cajun, and he knows the essentials, and he talks that way." He says, "I've always been a kind and loving man, sister. If I'm coming along the road, somebody's broken down at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to stop and help him, because that's who Lloyd LeBlanc is. That's who I am." And after this happened with David, and I felt that rising inside of me, like I wanted to do to those two fellas, as he put it, who killed our boy. I went, They killed our boy, but I'm not going to let them kill me. because if I give in to this hatred, I'm going to be dead too. And I'm going to keep on being Lord LeBlanc, and I'm going to do what Jesus said. And he set his face to go down the road of forgiveness. He's the hero of Dead Man Walking. I'm not the hero. I'm the storyteller. He's a hero. People like Marie Deans are the hero. And along the road these years, I have met incredible human beings. In the letter to the Hebrews, it talks about a cloud of witnesses. We have them. We have them among us. People who have lost loved ones, they've been in the white-hot fire of loss, and they choose not to let the hatred take them over because then they get lost themselves. One other example. I was given a talk in Denver. It was a ballroom. It was a big crowd. There were judges and lawyers and people, human rights community in Denver, which is very strong there. And then afterwards, people coming to get their book signed, as we'll do tonight. And it had been a long night, and the line had been long. And we come into the end of the night, and there are two guys at the end of the line. And so I'm getting a little zany, you know, a little slap happy, like end of the evening. And two more guys sign their books. We all go home. And I noticed they had been smiling and talking to each other. And so I just said to them, "Who are you two guys? What are you, a used car salesman or what?" I don't know why I said that. And by then they had approached the table and they were very close to me. And so one of them, he said, well, sister, we don't know how to tell you this exactly. And then he kind of looked over at the other man and he kind of smiled. He said, "Well, my son killed his son. And they were fathers from the Columbine shooting. And this father's son had killed the other one's son, and these two fathers found their way to each other to help heal and strengthen each other." The gospel of Jesus is alive in people, and we have embodiments of it in our midst. We pray that if we are ever tested, because we have these people who show us the way, that we too could make it, that we wouldn't give in to the hate. Even though the hate is legalized by the Supreme Court, and who has used words in the Furman decision and then in the Gregg decision that put the death penalty back, that execution does not take away the dignity of the human person. They use legalized language to say it's okay for the state to kill. And what do we know about the death penalty? It doesn't touch most of us personally. So how are we ever going to get involved in the issue or even think about it very? Please God, most of us don't have somebody murdered that we have to, we're forced to deal with it. So how do we get each other to go more deeply into something like the death penalty? To follow through on both arms of this cross, through Lloyd and Eula LeBlanc, I then began to go to murder victims' families' meetings, and that's when I learned how most people, like me, were just leaving them alone. People at these meetings were saying, "Our friends don't come see us. I guess it's just because we're in such great pain and they don't know what to do with our pain, so they all stay away from us. People in our church don't come either." And one, my good friend, we had always been friends, and I'd go to talk to her about Mary. My daughter was killed, and she'd say, "Please, Shirley, please. That's so painful. Shouldn't you be past that by now? Who's going to accompany them? What if in this church, what if in every Christian church, any community of believers, Jewish community, Christians, mosque, any religious tradition, we had an arm to reach out to those in prison, and we had an arm to reach out to victims of violence. Well, aren't we not called to reach out to both and not let the culture polarize us that we got to choose one side or the other?" So through Lloyd and Eula LeBlanc were the first, and then I'm in the death house with this man, Patrick Saunier, and the state of Louisiana is very serious about killing him. And it's this protocol of death. I couldn't imagine it ever happening. I'm in the death house with him because he's been brought there 3 days ahead of time. You can bring a change of clothes. You can bring your Bible. And Bible quotes are riddling this whole thing where people quoting God on both sides saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's the quotable quote that most people use for the death penalty, with few people quoting Jesus. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, but I say to you. Well, that kind of gets downplayed. Because, see, we can all be selective in our Bible quoting. Will Campbell, who was a Baptist preacher, who was put out of his church because he was against the death penalty, he calls it biblical quarterbacking. You toss your little quote from the Bible, I'm going to toss you my little quote from the Bible. And we can do that a long time because the Bible has a lot to it. And how many of us have studied Scripture? There were 37 different crimes in the Old Testament for which you could get the death penalty. 37. It wasn't just murder. How come people only quote that murder one? You could get it for not keeping the Sabbath, for touching sacred objects in the temple, sassing a priest. We could get it for him. And with college kids, you know, I bring out, you could get the death penalty for having sex with an animal. That animal, poor animal, consenting or not, got the death penalty too. 37 different crimes, but people only select out murder. You could get it for adultery, you could get it for homosexuality, you could get it for all this stuff. We have a great need for biblical literacy in this country. I'm not kidding you on this fact. I'm not throwing this in to give you a little levity of heart. 12% of people identified Joan of Arc as Noah's wife on this thing. Now that is pitiful. Father, we got a long way to go. Y'all teaching the Bible here? Yeah, we're teaching the Bible here. We went to Dominicans, and they're big on truth. And I'm with this man, and the tiles are polished, and the coffee pot's percolating, and it all feels like life. He's got 3 days to live, then he has 2 days to live, then he has 1 day. And I have been with him on this incredible spiritual journey. I have his Bible, where he underlined some of the psalms that I had never noticed before. Like Psalm 31, oh God, they plot to take my life, but you are my rock, on you I stand. They call me scum, they call me vermin. You are my rock on whom I stand. Where's Jesus in the death house? Whose side is Jesus on? Does Jesus say to us, look, as long as you make it legal, it's okay. It's okay. You got to protect yourselves against these people. You got to fight fire with fire. Tough love. Tough love. Very tough love. We're loving you now. We're strapping you down, hands and feet, and we're going to kill you, but this is love. We have a born-again Christian warden, holds the hands of people, prays, and signals to the executioner to kill him. Sometimes once they have the last meal with him, where they all hold hands, he presides like the father figure. They sing Christian hymns. Guards sitting around a table are going to strap him and kill him. The lawyer who put the death penalty in Louisiana, this is the first story in my second book, Death of Innocence, in the Dobie Gillis Williams story. This has gone on in our death house in Louisiana, where religion and state killing all get mixed up together. And I'm with this man, this human being, who is anguished over what happened with those kids. And I'll let you read Dead Man Walking to see the truth, because it was complex, about who did what. Eddie got life and Pat got death, and the truth of it was somewhere very different from that reality. But Pat has to face his own death, his own part in it, of the death of those kids. And he said, sister, when they dimmed the lights, this is when he was on death row, at midnight on the tier, I kneel down by my bunk and I pray with my Bible, and I pray to God to help those parents. That was never supposed to happen with those kids. And I know I feel responsible for it because Eddie lost control and I was part of all of it. And one night Eddie lost it. He never referred to himself as innocent. He was innocent of first degree murder, but he wasn't innocent. But then it's like the heart of the moral issue, the death penalty, is what do we do about the guilty? And in the second story in Death of Innocence and the Joseph Liddell stories, killed in Virginia. What were you doing on the night of July 23rd, 1997, when Virginia killed another man? Few of us probably can even summon up his name. Out of 98 executions, he was one among many. But 5 million people in Italy were tuned to their radios at night to see what happened to Joseph Liddell. The Italian parliament had spoken out for his life. He said from the moment he went in to prison that he was innocent. I got drawn into it. And it's through him and this woman lawyers who joined an innocence project and got involved in this case and summoned me into it that I got to have the dialogue with Pope John Paul, where I had a chance to put into his lap 14 years of experience with the death penalty. And I said, Your Holiness, does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life, as the Catechism says? What about the guilty? And when a man, no matter what his crime, is shackled hands and feet and is taken to his death and says to me, Sister, pray that God hold up my legs. There is no dignity in this death. Is it only the innocent? And of course we need to be pro-life and stand for the innocent, especially life vulnerable where it cannot protect itself. Little children, unborn babies, people with Alzheimer's who can't even say their name. We have to protect life where it's vulnerable. We have to protect the women if we want to protect the children. So women can choose life. We have to be those communities of support, not simply judge them. We have to be there for them. Pro-life across the board. And I said that to the Holy Father. I said, can we be pro-life across the board? And the Pope did a great thing. It's all in the story of Joseph Liddell. He changed the catechism. He intervened. He changed it to get us in a principled opposition to the death penalty, and now the bishops are behind it. And do you know that support among the death penalty and Catholics in this country is now the leading moral wedge among all the religions in this country? It has fallen below 50% because everybody now is doing their job. Priests are talking, people are being educated to be brought through it. It's not an easy journey to embrace both arms of this cross. And our own feelings of rage and outrage and all that goes on inside of us. But then we'd been knowing, haven't we? The gospel of Jesus is never easy. It's not the cultural thing. It's countercultural to what America teaches us often. That violence is a way we're going to solve social problems. Can it be? Just even think of the victims' families to be told to wait 20 years. And then finally they're going to be called in and they're going to sit in that chair and they're going to watch as the person's killed in front of their eyes. Does anyone think that there's another mother who's losing her child that night and is going to have to bury him in the days that are coming? Do we heal victims' families or do we multiply victims' families? What does violence do for us? What does it make of us? We are not worthy of the death penalty. And it's only because we haven't been given a chance to think about it. Patrick said to me there, Sister, you can't be there at the end. It's electrocution. It could scar you to see this. I don't want to see you harmed. You've been a great friend. You've been with me. And you've accompanied me, but you can't be there at the end. And I said to him, Patrick, I don't know what it's going to do to me. I've never done this in my life. But you are not going to die without a loving face to see. I will be the face of Christ for you. And when they do this, Patrick, you look at my face. And he did. And I walked out of that execution chamber. It was April the 5th. Just celebrated the anniversary of that death. 1984. And I walked outside. It was the middle of the night, it was dark, and I threw up. I'd never watched a human being killed in front of my eyes. It didn't help me at all that the Supreme Court said it was okay. You know, Thomas Merton says, when the world ends, it'll be legal. We got to examine what laws are and if they're according to the dignity of persons or they're not. I threw up, and then suddenly it came. People are never going to see this. It's in the middle of the night. It's behind prison walls. I'm a witness. And just like that epistle of John, what our eyes have seen and our ears have heard and our hands have touched, this is the gospel we proclaim to you. And out of that experience of being a witness, I began then. I said, I got to tell the story. And before the movie and the book and the opera and all that good Dead Man Walking stuff, we got everything but the ballet now of Dead Man Kicking. I'd go to give a talk and people would stand up and shout me down. Marie, you got to know about all this. And St. Christopher's Nursing Home, an announcement after lunch, who wants to hear the death penalty? None. Three people that day wanted to hear the death penalty, none. We went in one of these little parlors, and I'm not kidding you, after 10 minutes, it was after lunch, but two of them were gone. They're gone. One lady was awake, and I'm going, lady, don't leave me, like you're it. And then I wrote the book. And then Susan Sarandon read the book. A book is like a child. You never know where it's going to walk and where it's going to go. It has a life of its own. Susan Sarandon read it. She said, I got to meet you. We met. She said, we need a film to help bring the American public into a deeper reflection, and nothing can do that like a film. So the film came out. Every Hollywood studio turned down the script. They thought it was a downer. They said, well, Tim, they saying this to Tim Robbins, Tim, you got dead in the title. That's not exactly uppity. And then the guy's guilty, and he's going to be executed at the end. And then, Tim, you got a nun. I mean, like, it's got no romantic element in it. And their Hollywood solution was, well, let's spice it up between a nun and a death row inmate. And Tim is saying to him, it's a story about redemption. And they didn't get it. And they all turned it down. And PolyGram Film International, that only had done one successful movie called Four Weddings and a Funeral. They did albums. They picked it up. And providence of God, on the night of the Feast of the Annunciation, March 25th, with 1.3 billion people in the world, Susan steps up and receives the Oscar for her portrayal of a nun. And she hated the clothes. It was tough on her to do this role. And the movie was given over to the world. God uses us. We can't say I'm only one little ordinary person. Each of us, and it's like a big mosaic. We each are a different color. And we put our gifts together. And we do it. Everybody can't do everything. Not everybody's a public speaker. Not everybody can. But we put our gifts together. And we come around this Eucharistic table. And remember the one who loved us and taught us that we're to love in such a way that nobody can stay our enemy long. We love in such a way that we do not have enemies. Can we do that? Every day of our life we strive for it. And the gift of being Catholic is that we have wellsprings of spirituality that feed us and a call, a tremendous challenge to do social justice. Can we put them together? Around the dignity of the human person, which is what makes us truly pro-life, across the board, all life. I'll leave that invitation with you. I want to call to your attention that right here in Virginia, on June 13th, you're going to kill another man. And I have to say you, I have to say we, because we're a democracy. And if we're not doing anything to stop this or to change it, we're complicit. It's being done in our names. And there's going to be materials for you. Christopher Scott Emmett is going to be killed on June 13th. Will you be there in some way? Have you ever, with your body, given witness to your faith and to life on this? There will be some people there. I invite you to be a part of it. I'll be out there with the books. The money from the books goes to the moratorium campaign. And you can get the paperback of Dead Man Walking and Death of Innocence for $25. If you want to give more to the Moratorium Campaign, feel free. We have some books signed by Susan Sarandon and myself. That's a fundraiser book for $100 if anybody has a rich aunt. So I'll stop here.